We're starting a new chapter in the book of 1 Corinthians. It's oftentimes called the love chapter, and that always catches our attention, doesn't it? When we hear the word love, although you will not see it or hear it here in this chapter, because the word that we say, love, is translated charity here in this particular chapter. Chapter 13, the first three verses. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, and have not charity or love, I am become as sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains, and have not charity or love, I am nothing. We know that the church at Corinth possessed gifts, and that there were, as far as we can read in chapter 12, some 9 spiritual gifts that were exercised in the church at Corinth. Whether there were more in other churches or not, we do not know. But we do see and read of these 9 gifts mentioned here in this particular chapter. And we need to understand that they are gifts. They are called spirituals. Oftentimes, the word gift is not mentioned, but is supplied in our King James translation, but they are referred to in the original writings as the spirituals. And that simply emphasizes the fact that they were not something that the people developed, not something that they earned, but it was something that was bestowed upon them instantaneously by the Spirit of God for the good, for the welfare, for the edification, which is a word we see quite often in the New Testament. It means for the building up, for the edification of the church at Corinth, which is called the body of Christ. These people are referred to in other writings in the same book, 1 Corinthians, as being people who were immature. They are referred to as babies, that is, spiritual infants. They were also tolerative of those who were immoral, and the Bible tells us they were ignorant and they were carnal, that is, given to a lot of activity that involved the flesh. Now, these contributed to their abuse and overemphasis upon the gifts that the Spirit had placed in the church. And Paul wrote to correct this abuse in these chapters that we are studying now, and to instruct them about the future of gifts in the church. The idea of one thing replacing something that already existed was not a new concept. As far as religion is concerned, you know, oftentimes people have the idea that once God institutes something, that it is instituted forever. And people who are involved in the initial institution of some program or policy of God oftentimes are extremely reluctant to let what God has given them, let that go and receive what God replaces it with. And I think specifically of the church age replacing the law age under Moses. Now, it was prophesied that when the Lord Christ came and died on the cross, he would fulfill all of the law of Moses. That is, he would fulfill all of the sacrificial prophecies that had been uttered, and by being the offering himself, all of the offerings would cease after his death and resurrection. All other offerings would cease, and the Mosaic system would be fulfilled and replaced by the age of the church. But the Jewish people had been involved with the law system for hundreds of years, and there were many beautiful ceremonies, and they were comforted by what they had developed it into and the traditions that surrounded, and they were extremely reluctant to let the law system go. They were rebuked in many of the letters for still clinging to the Mosaic law system, although it was as fully fulfilled and completely abolished by the cross of Christ as anything possibly could be. Christ is the end of the law. Christ has taken it out of the way and nailed it to the cross. This is what Paul wrote concerning the law, and yet many, many of the people in the churches still clung to the law. They thought it was better. Book of Hebrews was written to show that the law was not a better day in a better way, but we have a far superior system of approaching God and worshiping God in the church age than people had in the law age of Moses. When we think then of something better than the spiritual gifts in the church and the fulfilling of the purpose of gifts, spiritual gifts in the church, people throw up their hands and say, "Oh, we're trying to take away what God put in the church." That's true. But God is the one who said it should be finally replaced, and that gifts would cease, that these gifts they relied upon so heavily, they would cease and be replaced and superseded by something superior. You know, God never replaces something that we love with something that's inferior. Although to hear the charismatics talk today that faith, hope, and love and the Word of God are far inferior to the gifts, but God says they're far superior. He says there's a more excellent way than the way of spiritual gifts in the church. There's a better way, but people were reluctant to leave them. They were shocked that God is going to take away the gifts and replace them with something other than those gifts. And these people at Corinth, they didn't want to give up their gifts. They'd had so much fun with the gifts, and I mean that literally. They had been such a source of entertainment and maybe comfort, and perhaps the only time that someone had ever really received the kind of recognition they thought they ought to receive was when they'd been possessed or had been given a particular gift and had been able to exercise it in the church, and they were determined that they would not allow these gifts to pass away, that they would use them. And that's exactly what happened. The gifts had come to possess the people rather than the people possessing the gifts. But the worst problem that developed with gifts in the church, such as the gift of prophecy and discerning of spirits and speaking in tongues and the interpretation of tongues, the worst problem that developed in the church at Corinth that is that these came to be exercised without love. The people were exercising the gifts. They were emphasizing the gifts And they were pointing to the gifts, and they were glorying in the gifts, and they were using the gifts not for the glory of God and not for the profit of the church, but for their own personal aggrandizement and minus love, negative love. And the kind of love that Paul writes about here is not eros, which is the word from which we have gotten the word erotic, which has to do with sexual passion or physical love. It's not the word phileo, which means to kiss or to love. It has in it the idea of human kindness one to another. Philadelphia, city of brotherly love, phileo. Or philanthropic, which has in it the idea of helping one another, philanthropy, which was the highest form of love known by the Greeks. But philanthropy was bestowed only when someone earned it, when someone deserved it. It had to do with rights and opportunities. Perhaps someone would become a great military leader, and then they would be the recipient of philanthropic endeavor in the sense that rights and privileges were bestowed upon them by the aristocracy. The word that's translated love here is agape, and it means bestowed love. It means love with no strings attached. It is a love that springs from the will or heart. It is self-denying, and it does not involve a swap out or a trade. Now, many times we get the idea that people are to be loved if they can conduct themselves in such a fashion as to deserve that love. Now, you may earn respect, and you might earn money, but the kind of love that is written about by Paul in this chapter is not the kind of love that you can earn. It's not the kind of love that you ever deserve. It is something that is bestowed, and there is a reason that such love is needed. We have to consider that there is no good in us in order for God to reciprocate then and bestow love upon us. One of the most damaging, the most heretical, and one of the most damnable things we could ever say to our children is, if you're not good, Jesus won't love you. Now that's rank heresy. That is rank heresy. We never should say that to our children. Oh, if you're not good, God won't love you. Because there's none good but God. We need this kind of love because none of us could have ever been saved without it. It's the love that God bestowed upon the world. For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in Him should not perish, but have everlasting or eternal life. We must have a ground or foundation upon which we stand to be like God. In other words, how can I display attributes of God in my life? Obviously, the wellspring of all things good is this kind of love. I cannot show the strength of God. I cannot demonstrate the wisdom of God. But if I receive the gift of love in this area, I can then be like God. But we'll find out tonight that this kind of love is in most ways degrading to humanity. Because this love is not dunamis, it is not power. And it does not insist upon power. It does not rest in power, but it rests rather in weakness. We'll see some of the characteristics of love this evening. We have to have this love in order to be saved, and we have to have it because of the imperfectibility of mankind. Our relationships in the home, and our relationship particularly in the church, demand this kind of love. It's the only way we can ever be what we must be in order to please God in our service. If we predicate our relationship upon what we do for one another, we are doomed to failure. If my relationship to you depends upon how many times we are joined together in some perfectly harmonious social activity, we're doomed to failure. If our service to God depends upon whether you get a card from me or I get a card from you, we're doomed to failure. If our relationship demands that I be right or that you be right, that no one makes any mistakes, that when a mistake is made, we will in anger separate, we are doomed to failure. You say, Brother Penn, if I ever see you do anything wrong, I'm leaving. Might as well leave now. You'll see me do something wrong. You say, well, I don't know what it was. You just hadn't been looking. You hadn't been around me. That's one reason I keep a distance from everybody. Now, I'm not lying altogether about that. If our relationship demands that you be flawless and I be flawless, we are doomed. I had a lady come to me one time and say, Brother Penn, I want you to pray for me that my husband will quit drinking. It seemed like a good prayer request. And I asked her why. I don't really know why I did that, but I just asked her, well, why? And she said, because he's so mean to me. I want him to quit drinking so he'll be good to me. I don't care if maybe his liver turns green, whatever it is, livers do. That, you know, if that's all there was to it, let him drink. But I want him to quit drinking so it'll be good to me. That's not love. Except self-love. I wish my husband would be saved and start going to church. Why? So it'd be a better husband. That's not love. That's not the kind of love we're talking about here. We're looking at the kind of love that completely ignores, that doesn't consider hurts and and all the other things that grind human relationships to pieces. All the little things we never knew we did, love doesn't consider those. And all the things that we did, love doesn't consider those. We have to have this kind of love. We have to have this kind of love. It is an absolute necessity. And the greater the gift of love, the better the church of the living God, the better our relationship one to another. Have you ever been around those people who say, if he ever wrongs me one time, that'll be the end of that? Boy, how do you live with people like that? And do they ever hurt anyone? Person who says, they said they'd call, but they didn't call, forget it from now on, I'm through with them. You ever forget to call? I mean, what kind of world would we have if everything is predicated upon everybody doing everything that we expect them to do for us? And the minute they fail, then, hey, forget it. You ever wonder why many people don't have many friends? Because the demand is just too great to be their friend. It's just too heavy to bear. The load is too heavy to bear. It takes every ounce of every day of energy and strength just to quote love that one person. It demands everything and then ultimately fails. You might wonder, I don't have any close friends at all. You might wonder, do you make too many demands out of these people? Are you willing to love them for what they are and love them in spite of what all of, quote, their faults? It's sort of hard to talk about, isn't it? Love them for their faults. What about loving one another in spite of all of our faults? There has to be that kind of situation. God knew it. Now, the gift of tongues was being exercised without love. Paul said, though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, and the word tongues here means languages, which is further proof that tongues, quote, were not a nonsensical gibberish. Men means mankind, the languages of mankind. Or if I could speak in an angelic tongue, the tongue of an angel. I don't think Paul is talking about the gift of oratory here and the ability to spellbind a congregation of people by an almost godlike oratory. You know what he's talking about? He is talking about the gift of tongues. And Paul said, if I had the gift of tongues, so that I could speak the languages of men, or I could speak the languages even of angels, which would not be necessary, but it would certainly be an accomplishment. This is what Paul is talking about. And have not charity or love. Paul said, I am become as sounding brass, or a tinkling cymbal. Sounding brass literally means a sound of any sort that is not, well, it's not even a musical instrument. It's just noise in general, what we might term racket. Paul said, though I speak with the tongues of men, the languages of mankind, the languages of humanity, and even the language of an angel, and have not this agape love, I am just making a lot of racket. I am become as sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. Tinkling cymbal has in it the idea of a clanging cymbal. A cymbal means a dish, a basin, and it described the shape of the instruments that were brought together in order to produce a sound. These are cymbals. Some writers think that Paul means these small cymbals. Some think that he meant the large cymbals. But these are cymbals that are used in Hindu worship services in India. They're legitimate. They're not copies. They're bought right off the rack where the Hindus buy them. But doesn't that help you a lot? I notice y'all are really enthused about that. Do you get the message? I have a message for you. You know what it is? That's the message right there. Help you a lot? You like that? How about 30 minutes of it? Well, you say, we already had. No, you hadn't. No. I'm not that bad. A clanging cymbal. Now, you know, sometimes people say, Brother Penn, you really preach hard against things you don't believe in. You just get really crude and, you ought to have more love. Well, now wait just a minute. What do you think these people felt like whenever they read Paul's writing and he said, your tongue speaking is a bunch of racket and it doesn't have any more meaning than people banging cymbals together? Think that hurt their feelings? I think that was a little rude. Have you ever heard anyone spoken of as being such a nice person that they never hurt anybody else's feelings or they never spoke illy of anyone else? They surely lived a sheltered life. I've heard ministers described as, oh, he was a wonderful man. He loved everyone. He never got on to anybody. He never mentioned anybody's name except to speak good of them. He didn't know many people. Because if he had told the truth about some of the people I know, he would have spoken illy of them. That's not love. Love rebukes when rebuke is needed. Love will hurt us because love is a truth speaker. The gift of tongues without love was a sounding brass and tinkling cymbal. There were other gifts that were exercised without love. For instance, the gift of prophecy, that is, to speak forth in warning. And Paul said, if I speak the gift of prophecy or use or demonstrate the gift of prophecy, he doesn't say you're like a tinkling, like racket and a beating cymbal. He says, you're nothing. I am nothing. Understanding all mysteries. An ability to comprehend the incarnation of God in Jesus Christ. Perhaps the greatest or highest exercise of the gift of knowledge itself. But to be able to exercise this gift minus of love, Paul said, I am nothing. If you wonder what the word nothing means in Greek, it means nothing. All knowledge, the gift of knowledge, the gift of insight and truth. I am nothing. Well, you say, I'm willing to accept that. And though I have all faith, what kind of faith are you talking about? All faith. Now, tell me the kind of faith exactly. Describe the kind of faith that I could have. So that I could remove mountains. Not singular, not so that I could remove a mountain, so that I could remove mountains. And evidently he alludes to a time when Christ spoke of faith as a mustard seed, when we could say to a tree, "Be thou plucked up and cast into the ocean," and it would be done. And he is now saying that if we exercise the gift of faith by plucking up mountain ranges, mountains plural, and casting them into the sea. Now notice, that kind of faith, he said, "I am nothing." When such things are done without love, they're done for oneself. And then this is what Paul finally tears apart and lets us see. That sometimes we can so love ourselves that we'll make every kind of sacrifice in the world just to have the kind of feeling we get when other people talk about how great a sacrifice we have made. And when we do that, Paul said, it profits us nothing. And that pretty well places what we call motive in perspective. I was listening to a talk show the other day, and that really tells you how low I've been this weekend, doesn't it? I mean, when anybody gets so lonesome and so depressed, they listen to talk shows, especially call-in psychologists. You know you're hurting bad. But I don't know who this dear person was, you know, dear Abby, dear Jane, but this was dear somebody. It happened to be on the car radio, and I just didn't change the channel. And this lady had called in and talking about how she was 60 years old, and now everyone just treated her like she was a carpet, a rug, and gave her no respect or anything. And she said, I really don't know why, because I've always done everything for anybody they always ask me to. And this lady with a real weird name, don't remember it, said, "Well, you have what we call the puppy dog syndrome. You know, you're just sitting there and all you get out of life is people patting you on the head and calling you a good little woman, you know. Puppy dog syndrome." And I thought, now that lady is 60 years old, and now she is trying to find some sort of direction in life, and she really thinks that all the sacrifices she made, that all these people are just going to leap up and say, "But she did all these things for me, now let me do for you." People just don't do that way. You know, the idea that we can't be loved without being perfect, and we can't be loved unless we do everything for everybody all the time. This is not what God's talking about. This is not what Paul has in mind here. Notice what he says. He said, "And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor." Now, what better move could a person make in life than to take everything they have? In fact, Jesus even gave this advice to a rich young ruler on one occasion. "But take everything you have and haul it down to the Salvation Army or down to Uncle Pearl's and give it to these people so that all the trash and tramps can eat and have clothes to wear." I mean, take everything, sell your house, sell your automobile, and bestow it upon the poor people and walk away with nothing. Zero. Zilch. You know anyone who ever did that? That about outdo some of the terrible sacrifices I hear people talking about who come to church. That'd just about outdo anything I've ever heard of, to be quite honest with you. It'd far outdo anything I've ever done. Now, what's he say about that? It profits me nothing. That's rather a unique phrase. It'd profit those poor people, wouldn't it? But it wouldn't profit you any. It profiteth me nothing. The word profit has in it the idea of making it of service. That is, it would not enhance your ability to serve, is literally what it means. My, how we would laud a person who did that. How we would call attention to them. How we would brag on those people. And I think this fits in well with the words of Jesus, who said concerning almsgiving that we not do it for our own self. Because when it's done for self, then it is not a profitable exercise. You call it religion. You call it whatever you want to, but it profits you nothing. You know, I'm interested. What does it do for me? It does nothing for you. There is no enhancement. There is no enrichment. Others may be enhanced. Others may be helped. Others may be enriched. And the poor might get a good meal that they haven't gotten in a long time. But it will not make you a better servant of God. Isn't that discouraging? He said, well, I've given away everything I've ever owned in life. I've given up every dream I've ever had for God, for others. I've lived in obscurity. I have lived a life of self-denial. I have lived ragged and tattered so that everyone else could have everything. Now I've come down to the end of my life and I'll give the ultimate. I will give myself in sacrifice, or I will burn my body as a sacrifice to God. And I don't know of anything that ought to be more important to us than our bodies, or more precious as far as life is concerned. And it has reference to a religious sacrifice. Doesn't mean to burn out in God's service. It literally means to set yourself on fire. Self-destruction, self-immolation. You say, surely this would impress God. But God says of such an activity, and have not love, it profits me nothing. And yet we think that's the highest sacrifice, that God is so well pleased when we ruin ourselves serving God. If burning yourself literally to death without love did not profit you anything or receive a commendation from God, why would killing ourselves in some other way please God? A lot of times we're given only two opportunities in life, and that is to rust out or burn out. What about wear out? I like that better. Somebody says, brother, if you don't burn out, you'll rust out. I don't believe that. I don't think you ought to rust out, and I don't think you ought to burn out. I think you ought to wear out. That's far better and far more in line with God's will. But whether you rust out, burn out, or wear out, if it's not done because of love, it profits nothing. The gift of love is necessary to acceptable service to God and mankind. When people can, and there are people who do some rather extraordinary things for money, And there are people who do some rather extraordinary things because they hate. But there's not any motive in all the world that'll do what love will do. And the description of what love will do and what it won't do and what it thinks and what it doesn't think, its behavior, is one of the most unique and the most revealing, perhaps one of the most hurting things that we can study in the Word of God. It doesn't feel good to be just stripped bare spiritually, and for God to shine His light of revelation in on us and let us see us or ourselves for what we really are. And that's what Paul does as he gives the characteristics of this love.